It would not be possible for me to say what I'm going to say now without the reality of some of the things that have already been discussed at the conference over the last couple of days. So the title you can see there is The Patriarchs in Egypt, Lessons for the Church. And if you stop to think for a moment, that is a bonkers idea, really. We're talking about just shy of four millennia between Abraham and us. The pyramids had been built by the time Abraham went to Egypt, but still, you know, how could we realistically expect to learn any lessons for the church in the 21st century AD from things that happened so long ago? Only if there are those repeated patterns in history that we've been talking about, that in the life of Joseph and his experience, we see something of a foreshadowing of God's redemptive purposes in Christ. And if we can make a parallel from Joseph to Christ, then we can also draw a parallel from Christ to his body, the church of which he is the head. As was discussed, I think, in the very first session yesterday, remember how Christ identified, almost the first theology that Saul of Tarsus learned was that Christ identifies himself with his church. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? So because of that, I think we can look into these patriarchal narratives in Genesis and draw some lessons legitimately for today's church. Not just because we can make things fit and find analogies, but because there is a shape to history, and that is a God-given shape, and that's the way it works. Having said that, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy. And I have given a paper on a previous occasion along these lines, but more or less, what lessons can we learn from the whole of the Old Testament about how we should live in contemporary society? And I spent 9/10 of the paper saying, well, caveats, and well, we can't do this, and we really can't do that. And so there is a bit of that today, but I think there are some lessons that we can draw from the patriarchs in Egypt. Why is it worth doing this? So having established, I hope very briefly, that it can be done, why is it worth doing? And I think the reason why it's worth doing is because there is an enormous amount of debate fueled by anxiety in the church today about our relationship to society at large. When I bought my ticket this morning at the railway station, the railway company that's now taken over the franchise on my route has decided that its approach to customer relations is no longer to give information about whether trains are early or not, but to put nice little uplifting sentiments on the whiteboard as you go past. And I'll read you this morning's. Life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. Discuss. Not really. But, I mean, I had half an hour standing up on the train this morning to formulate what I would like to graffiti along the bottom of that. You can discuss that on the way home. I was going to say, then we're all doomed. But isn't it interesting that somebody can put that out there as a slogan and we'll all nod yes. Life is really about creating yourself, really? But it doesn't it show that we are living in what feels to be a very alien world now and a rapidly morphing society as well. Now, at this point, I was going to use an illustration from film, and it's always perilous. How many of you have seen the second Terminator film? Is it worth doing it for you guys? If you can think, the bit at the end where the bad robot, the sort of grown-up version of Enid Blyton's bad clockwork clown, is in his death throes in the molten steel. And at that point, in his agony, he morphs instantaneously from one shape to the other, all the different forms that he has taken throughout his pursuit of the good robot. Okay, some of you are now thinking, what? Never mind. But it feels sometimes as though our society, maybe I'm too optimistic in saying it's in the death throes, but it does sort of feel sometimes as if our society is morphing from one thing into another faster than people can keep up with. You know, I really do. And this is not ironic, I do feel sorry for those conscientious vegetarians who for 30 years or so have taken a conscientious moral stand against eating meat, and now they've just been marginalised, because it's vegan or nothing now, isn't it? And the conscientious feminists who have fought for the rights of women, and now it's the right to choose whether you're a woman or not. And in all sorts of areas, our society seems to be morphing so quickly that we don't even know which society we're addressing anymore. And that creates a great deal of anxiety, I think, in churches. And so I want to try and address some of that, some of our approach to living in the world from the idea of the patriarchs living in the world themselves. So the obvious place to begin in dealing with contemporary issues is at the turn of the millennium. Unfortunately, I mean the first millennium. And I want to introduce you to a hero of mine, Aelfric the Grammarian. Household name, I know. What a guy. I just love this guy. He was an Anglo-Saxon scholar, abbot of Cerne Abbas in Dorset, and he was one of the people called upon to produce the Anglo-Saxon Hexateuch translation of the first six books of the Bible. And he wrote this wonderful, it's called, often called the preface to Genesis, but it's really just a moan, really. He writes to his patron. There's none of the sort of Renaissance obsequiousness that you get with Calvin. You know, he just goes right there and says, you asked me to do this, and I said no. You said, okay, only do as far as Abraham sacrificing Isaac. And I still thought it was a really bad idea, and I do think it's a bad idea. But against my better judgment, I've agreed to do it, because if I don't do it, somebody else will, and at least I'll make a proper job of it. That's why I like the guy. So, very careful scholar, really interested in language, and also quite a profound thinker. So there I am, reading through his preface to Genesis, as it's now known. This is an illustration, by the way. This is not copyright. As it happens, there's an illustration of Jacob appearing before Pharaoh, which is brilliant because it ties in with a passage we'll look at later on that Gary read for us. Anyway, there was a moment when I was reading this, sitting on the train, and it was as though Aelfric had drawn a bow and fired an arrow into the sky 1,000 years ago, and I looked up and it hit me there. And I hope it's going to hit you there in a moment, because I'm going to give you two things that he says. The first one is quite an obvious thing. The first one is, he thinks that translating Genesis out, this is out of Latin into Old English, the language of the Anglo-Saxons. He thinks it's a bad idea, because lay people will get hold of it and assume, when they look at the lives of the patriarchs, that it's okay for them to marry their sister and have several wives. And in the newly Christianized but deeply pagan society of the time, that was a real worry. But it shows how dangerous and difficult it is to draw lessons from narratives. And Gary read for us the narrative in the second half of Genesis 12, and I hope you'll agree that that's not necessarily immediately obvious how you apply it in giving lessons for how we should live in contemporary society as a church. But this is the arrow between the eyes. Joseph, he says, is of course a type of Christ. If he were here at the conference, he would say, the meaning of the Joseph narrative is that Christ came into the world to save sinners. What are you talking about? What other meaning could there be? But he says this, that Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt in order to save the Egyptians from famine. And that is a picture of Christ coming into the world to save us from the pains of hell. And the thing that hit me between the eyes was, Joseph was sold into slavery to save Egypt? And then, of course, your first thought is, well, he lived 1,000 years ago. What did he know? And then your second thought is, maybe he's got a point. And in the reading we had in the last session, from chapter 50, Joseph says to his brothers, you intended it for evil, God intended it for good, in order that we might save, what does it say? Yeah, a numerous people. He doesn't specify. And they were so used to the idea that God saves his elect, and that the whole purpose of Joseph being in Egypt was to preserve the seed line of promise, Jacob's sons and all the rest of it, that maybe we've missed one of the obvious things in the text, which is that Joseph was the means of the salvation of the Egyptians as well, in some sense. And that makes you think, maybe, just possibly, God sent his son into the world not to condemn the world, but that through him the world might be saved. I've read that somewhere. And maybe that the purpose of the church in the world is not to condemn the world, but that through the church the world might be saved. Wow, there's a radical thought. So how are we going to get there? So this is my methodology. We must approach this question not by homing in on individual narratives and trying to pick out points of application from that. We've got to approach it with a theology. And the theology is the theology of Israel and the nations. And this is established firmly after the flood in Genesis by the juxtaposition of the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, all the descendants of Noah branching out to become all the nations and people groups and places of the known world to the Sinai generation. And then immediately we get the genealogy of Abraham in chapter 11. And that's telling you that there's this worldwide, you know, a world covered with people, and then there's God's choice of an individual. And those two are somehow related. And of course, the relation is the call of Abraham in chapter 12. And Abraham is called out of the world. He's told to forsake his family, his father's house, to move away from the place that he's known, the comfort and security of Ur of the Chaldees, which was a very civilized place. They had supermarkets and drains and all sorts of things. And yet it's a calling also to be in the world. He's taken to a place and to dwell among people groups. And so God's call of Abraham, if you like, God's election of Abraham, is not God's repudiation of the world. It is rather the means through which God is going to reach the world. And particularly in the terms of Genesis 12, it is, of course, through the blessing and cursing. So God says, I will bless those who bless you, but the one who disdains you I will curse. I'll come back to that in a minute. And all the clans of the earth will find blessing in you, or something like that anyway. And this promise, if you can see the bottom of the screen, is reiterated in all these places, in chapter 18 and 22 to Abraham, chapter 26 to Isaac, and also chapter 28 to Jacob. So this is central to God's covenant with Abraham, this being the focus of blessing and cursing on the nations. So then, I'm going to say that Abraham's call is a call to come out and also to dwell among. And there's a sort of a tension or a harmony in that. This is the story of the Old Testament. Walter Kaiser said that those three verses at the beginning of Genesis 12 are the most important verses in the Old Testament. And whilst we could argue about that, you can see why he says that. And from that point onwards, you get these reverberations as the Old Testament unfolds, moving on this diagram from left to right. You see that the knowledge of God through Israel's contact with nations spreads wider and wider as the Old Testament goes on. Sometimes it is through Israel being on the ascendancy, as it is in the time of Solomon. Sometimes it's through the nations coming in judgment. But either way, God's purpose remains the same. And so even at the moment of collapse, if you like, when God reverses the Exodus and throws his people out of the land to exile in Babylon, there is still a Daniel in the court of Nebuchadnezzar revealing mysteries from the living God to the court of the Babylonians. And so you could say that the intertwined relationship between Israel and the nations is the double helix of the DNA of the Old Testament. If you use that, I want royalties, because that is original. Okay, but it's quite a useful way of thinking about the Old Testament. So how does that work out then in Genesis? So I have actually printed 45 copies of this, which are probably still sitting on the photocopier. So you can pick one up at the end if you want. And if you were here 2 years ago when I did a thing on birth narratives in Genesis, you can take this diagram, put it on top of the other one, hold it up, and you get a sort of mega diagram with all the Toled Oath and the birth narratives and everything on there, but it's probably a bit of a mess. So anyway, this demonstrates, hopefully, the 50 bars running across from left to right are the 50 chapters of Genesis. And above these, in these boxes here, we have all the nations who are given birth to during the narratives in Genesis, many of them coming, of course, from Abraham and his seed, but not within the promised line. And then underneath, I've explained that these coloured bars refer to all the narratives where the patriarchs are interacting with members of other nations. And I've colour-coded them so that the turquoise ones are in Egypt, and the yellow ones are Mesopotamia, Aram, and the pink ones are other people groups in Canaan. Just to save a lot of time reviewing ground, and also to demonstrate, hopefully visually, that an awful lot of the time, a lot of the narratives in Genesis are involved with Abraham and his descendants interacting with members of other people groups. And of course, all the white bits in between take place in the promised land, which is precisely that. It is a land promised but not yet given. So even when Abraham and Jacob and Isaac are doing things among themselves in the promised land, they're still living in the middle of the world because they don't own that land yet in the way that Israel possessed it later on. So I'm concentrating then in this talk on the turquoise bits, Israel in Egypt. So Egypt first comes up in the Table of Nations, and if you don't know Hebrew, you may miss the fact that Mitzrayim is Egypt. So these are in the sons of Ham, and it's just interesting that Egypt is related to Canaan and to the Philistines. So that's the first mention of Egypt. Then where do we go? This is just surveying the data. So we begin with the story that Gary read about Abraham in Egypt, and then we come down to Hagar the Egyptian. And there is a connection here. This is my little Hagar slide. It's not really Hagar, but it's an Egyptian slave woman. There's a connection. I don't know whether you picked it up in that reading, but Abraham was given lots of stuff by Pharaoh, including male and female servants. So you think, well, here is Abraham. He's done quite well out of this disaster, really, because he's sort of plundered Egypt in a way, hasn't he? He's come out of Egypt with all this stuff. But coming out with Hagar has consequences later on. So that's the second narrative in which Egypt features, although it's not set in Egypt, it's Hagar the Egyptian who bears Abraham the son Ishmael and so on. Then we have Isaac who is forbidden from going to Egypt because when there's a famine. And so he goes and lives in Gerar instead and gets into the same mess that Abraham had in Egypt. And then finally, of course, we've got the chapters of Joseph in Egypt. Now, there's a bit in between here. A couple of other little comments. First of all, in chapter 13 and verse 10, when Abraham and Lot are having a friendly disagreement about who's going to live where and all the rest of it, Lot chooses the land. And the land that he chooses to the east of the Dead Sea is described as like the land of Egypt, like the garden of the Lord in terms of its fertility. So Egypt here is being described as Eden-like in its fertility. And presumably that's because it had a river running through the middle of it and guaranteed water supply. The next is a similar comment. About Egypt. It's not strictly set in Egypt, but just a comment that indicates that the border of Egypt is inviolable in God's purposes. The promised land stops at the border of Egypt. Ishmael dwells and operates in a certain area as far as, but no further than the border of Egypt. So Egypt is kind of over a line. It's on the other side of a border, and the people of God are not to find their destiny there. So that's surveying the ground of what Genesis has to say about Egypt. Now let's look at some theology of Egypt in Genesis. So there's a really useful, helpful little article. Helpful and little go together for me. You know, the shorter the article, the better. And there's this nice little article by Ian Duggett in the Westminster Theological Journal about Hagar and the allure of Egypt in the Abraham cycle. And he shows that all the way through the Abraham cycle, particularly, Egypt is presented as a fertile alternative to God's purposes. So in chapter 12, that Gary read to us, that narrative begins, there was a famine in the land, and so where did Abraham go? He went to fertile Egypt and survived and came out with great possessions, but it wasn't entirely trouble-free. And similarly, he says, Sarah, who is the one through whom the promised line will come, is barren, whereas Hagar is fertile, and she can have a son very readily. But of course, that son is not the one, Ishmael is not the one, in whom God's purposes lie. And so Ian Duggett is tracing this line all the way through, that Egypt is always kind of there, just over the border, presenting itself as the easy way of achieving the things which God has promised, but as yet Abraham and the other patriarchs are still waiting for. I think that's really insightful and helpful. But I will come back to this because it's not straightforward how we understand that. That's one thing, but it's not the only thing. So there's also, I would argue, the blessing and cursing theme of Genesis 12 verse 3 that works itself out in the patriarchs in Egypt. So first of all, in the narrative that we just read, it seems to me that the only safe way of making sense of that narrative initially is to see it as a fulfillment of what a few verses earlier it talks about, the blessing and cursing. So Abraham is the nexus of God's plans and purposes. He goes to Egypt, and how the Egyptians treat him will determine how God treats the Egyptians. And because they unwittingly disdain Abraham, they make light of him by taking his wife, then God curses them. And that seems to me the only sane and rational way of making anything of that narrative. And you'll notice that it is irrespective of Abraham's moral behavior or ethical behavior. It's what Abraham has been called to be. God doesn't say conditionally, I will make you a blessing and a curse so long as you live an ethical Christian life or whatever. He just says that's what you are. It's ontological. And I'll come back to that point later on. Then we move to Joseph in chapters 39 to 50. And if you just turn for a moment to chapter 39... The beginning of chapter 39, Joseph in Egypt abounds with a language of blessing. In the first three verses, verse 2 to verse 5, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household, of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. Verse 21 in the same chapter. Joseph in prison. The Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warder. So the warder put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warder paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. And so here we see Joseph similarly being the nexus of God's blessing. And when Egyptians treat him kindly, as Potiphar did, at least initially, and the jailer and so on, blessing comes to them simply by Joseph's presence there. There are other references as well outside of the Egypt story. So Laban as well speaks about Jacob, and it's very clear he's echoing Genesis 12 verse 3, whether he understood that he was doing that or not, in the language he uses, to recognize that God is with him and God is blessing him. And then we come to Jacob and Pharaoh in chapter 47 that again Gary read to us, 47 verse 7. And then Joseph brought his father Jacob in and presented him before Pharaoh. After Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Pharaoh asked him, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult." Was that irony? I don't know. "And they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers." Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. Now you would think, wouldn't you, that in the circumstances, Jacob ought to be the asylum seeker who is looking for a blessing from Pharaoh. And one explanation that I've come across with this is that by the age of 130, Jacob has already lived 20 years longer than the ideal lifespan, according to Egyptian thinking. So if this man has lived 130 years, he is a very significant man. And therefore, I want his blessing, says Pharaoh. But again, in fulfillment of Genesis 12, verse 3, we see here that there is a situation where Pharaoh and Jacob are good for each other. And it's not an empty thing that Jacob blesses Pharaoh, I don't think. And, of course, earlier on, I'll come back to this later on, Joseph has been the means through which Pharaoh has been blessed in the salvation of Egypt, and also the rising to international prominence of Egypt and the strengthening of Pharaoh's power over the land of Egypt. It's all been due to Joseph. And so Joseph has been the means of blessing Egypt as well. I might have been missing out. Okay. Just to show you that again, it's a brilliant illustration of Jacob blessing Pharaoh. And then, you know, arguably, we were talking this morning about where do the Joseph narratives end. You could argue, I'm not seriously arguing this, but you could argue in the middle of the first chapter of Exodus. Because there's certainly a lot of linkage, isn't there, between the first eight verses of Exodus chapter 1 and the rest of Genesis. And, of course, the point there is another Pharaoh arose who didn't know Joseph. And many people think, I think, it makes sense that that's a new dynasty takes over, and all the, therefore, collective history, collective memory of what's gone on between Joseph and his descendants and the Egyptians is lost, and things change. And, of course, as that Egyptian dynasty begins to oppress the people of Israel, then God will come and curse them. And so we get the curses, or the signs. Actually, they are called signs more than they are called plagues in the book of Exodus. So the blessing turns to cursing. The final thing then is instructions about bones. Both Jacob and Joseph made these instructions that they were not to be buried in Egypt, and I think this relates again to the inviolable nature of the border between Egypt and the Promised Land. We do not belong in Egypt. However much we belong here, we don't belong here. However much we've been in a symbiotic relationship with Egypt, we've been the means that they've blessed us and we've been the means of blessing them. It's not our home. It's not God's plan. It's not his purpose. This is not where we should be living. And that's, again, very important, and we'll make some points of application from that. Now, I think it's very interesting that in Genesis 15, God actually refers to the affliction of Israel in Egypt and says that for 400 years you'll be in this other land, you'll be oppressed and so on. But he doesn't name them. He doesn't say it's Egypt. I just think this is really interesting. If Genesis is written from the perspective of the Sinai generation, you would think, you know, surely just name Egypt. There are other references. The word for plagues used in Genesis 12, the plagues that come on Pharaoh's house, is the same as the word used for plagues in Exodus. So there are lots of Exodus references. But the thing that's particularly interesting is that there are also opportunities for demonizing Egypt that the author of Genesis does not take. And he doesn't, in chapter 15, when he's talking about the oppression of Israel in exile, he doesn't spell out that it's going to be in Egypt. And it's interesting, there's a bit of a debate, because Hamilton, in his commentary on Genesis, says, well, Abraham would have been able to figure this out for himself. And I think, really? Are you sure about that? That Abraham would have twigged that? And so, although there are these hints, if you like, that Egypt is a little bit menacing, is a little bit beyond a line, is a little bit of an alternative to God's plans and purposes, there is no demonization of Egypt or the Egyptian people. So, to put it this way, Egypt is not the empire and Pharaoh is not Darth Vader. It's not binary. It's not a simple relationship that Abraham has to Egypt that the people of God have to the world. So then, some application at this point, and then I've got another point with some application as well. Christians often look for specific do's and don'ts. What can I join in with and what can I not join in with in terms of the world around me? And I think this is asking the wrong question. I think we've got to begin with who we are and why we are in the world. So we've got a call to be out in order to be in as well. And I think the point is that our role is also ontological, as Abraham's was. So Abraham became the channel of God's purposes for the world. Christ tabernacled in the world for the same reason, and the church as the body of Christ continues to tabernacle in the world to continue this role. So we repudiate the world in terms of our allegiance to unbelieving humanity, just as Abraham was called to turn his back on his family, his heritage, his homeland and everything. But our spiritual allegiance is not achieved by our denial of our place in creation, for one thing, and I think there is a kind of reformed asceticism that we see in lots of areas, but particularly in sermons which never make application to living in the real world. That's a kind of asceticism if we never say how a Christian should live in today's society. Also, we've got to be clear about where we belong. So that's another issue to do with allegiance, that we don't seek blessing through the world. We don't seek the blessings which God has promised us in Christ. We don't try and find an alternative route to that blessedness or happiness in the unbelieving world. Now, here's the thing. Egypt was not culpable for its fertility. You can't blame Egypt for being fertile. God had given them a whacking great river. So if the patriarchs are attracted to Egypt for its fertility, it's not Egypt's fault. Hagar was made a concubine by Sarah and Abraham. It is their fault that she became a concubine, and all the other resulting problems from that is no fault of hers. Pharaoh was blameless for desiring Sarah. He, after all, he'd been told that she was Abraham's sister. And apart from a general condemnation of slavery in the ancient world, Potiphar was not culpable for buying Joseph, if we accept, as people did at the time, that slavery was a fact of life. The fault in all these cases lies with the people of God. They were the ones who desired Egypt. They were the ones who made a concubine out of Hagar. Abraham was the one who deceived Pharaoh. Joseph's brothers were the ones who sold him into slavery. So the fault lies not out there, but in here. It is the world within us that is the big problem, not the world outside us. And the problem so often when we are wondering about how to live in the world is not because of what's happening outside us, it's because of what's going on in here. But the blessing-cursing role is ontological. I think I mean ontological rather than existential. But you can correct me if you want. But I think you get what I mean. Jesus said, you, emphatic pronoun, are the salt of the earth. You, emphatic pronoun, are the light of the world. He didn't say, I want you to try and strive really hard to be salty or to be lighty or to be illuminated or whatever. He said, this is what you are. It's ontological. The danger is that you hide it and that you fail to live up to it. But this is actually what you are. Similarly, the Apostle Paul said, you're the fragrance of life and death in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, 14 to 16. That's what you are. You don't have to try to be it. You are it. What you've got to make sure you don't do is deny it. Now, why did Abraham do this? Why did he cease to be salty and illuminating when he went down into Egypt? And in the other narratives, of course, with Abraham and Abimelech and Isaac and Abimelech, the same thing applies. In every case, it is fear. Fear of the world that made them hide their light under a bushel, to mix my testaments. And in one of the narratives, he actually says this. He is afraid. And so Abraham's loss of distinctiveness and his compromise of his allegiance was through fear of the world. And to me, this is a massive danger for the church today. We are salt and light. We don't have to try to think of too many strategies to be salt and light. It's ontological. But what we do have to do is not hide it because we're afraid of how the world will react. I'm going to have to move on quite quickly. Now, there's another strain in the other chapters, the final chapters from 37 to 50, and that is wisdom. Very helpful book here, Joseph Wise and Otherwise by Lindsay Wilson, who's an Australian evangelical. He's even got 10 pages in here on why Genesis 38 belongs where it does. And he points out many of the wisdom features in the Joseph narratives. He doesn't say that the Joseph narratives are a wisdom text, but he says there's a lot of wisdom-type things going on in that. So I'm just going to go through them very quickly. Joseph is described, or Joseph says, you need a discerning and wise man, and Pharaoh says, you're him. He has insight and foresight. He uses power for good ends. He effects reconciliation, not revenge. He rejects the immoral woman, which is a big theme in Proverbs 1 to 9, isn't it? His character is proven through hardship, like Job. So when I talk about wisdom, I'm talking about, as in the terms of Old Testament wisdom literature that we find in Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, particularly, and elsewhere in the Old Testament. There are some other things as well, which I'll come on to in a moment. A couple of nice little sound bites. Joseph contrasted with Jacob, because Jacob is clever and crafty in the same way that Amnon in 2 Samuel 13 is described as chacham, wise. But in the context, rightly, it's translated as crafty. So what's the difference between Jacob and Joseph? And so here's this nice thing from this writer, Wills, that Jacob is clever enough to get what he wants. Joseph is wise and righteous enough to get what he deserves. And that's quite helpful, I think, in understanding that biblical wisdom is not just being cleverer. So you'll be relieved to hear that as Christians, we're not called upon just to be cleverer than the rest of the world. there are other aspects of wisdom in these narratives. I'm sorry, I'm rushing over this quite quickly. The hidden God motif. So Joseph has to find his own way in the world. He doesn't have a direct revelation from God saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. He isn't told by God to do this or to do that. And that's a characteristic of wisdom literature, that we are living under the sun in God's created world, and very often without a direct revelation, without a thus says the Lord prophetic voice, we have nonetheless to apply Torah and live wisely. The significance of human actions and initiatives is another feature of Old Testament wisdom literature. So against a very deterministic view of God's sovereignty in the world, wisdom literature teaches us that at the same time, what we do and think and act, how we act matters. And also there's no polemic against Egypt's theology. I don't think Pharaoh's Egyptian pantheon was particularly challenged by his interaction with Joseph, although it was the means by which he was blessed, and particularly humility. Joseph demonstrates a great deal of humility. He doesn't say, well, when I was 17, I had these amazing dreams that put me, you know, the whole family was bowing down to me and so on. So, you know, it's just outrageous that I should be sold as a slave, and I'm just, you know, I'm not going to put up with it. But rather, he accepts his place, accepts the things that he can't change, and he acts wisely and winsomely in all the ways that I've just described in those circumstances, whether he gets thrown in prison or raised to high office. The outcome doesn't determine his actions. His actions are determined by wisdom, and a massive part of wisdom, according to Proverbs and elsewhere, is humility. So I'm going to make a few conclusions now about that, what that means for us, because, you know, it would be very easy at this point to say, well, yes, the lesson for us from the patriarchal narratives in Egypt is that being salt and light is ontological. Amen. Let's go home. But we've still got to deal with the details about how we live in the world. And your congregation still have to deal every day with the questions that they come up with in the workplace, in the home, and all those things. And it seems to me that wisdom literature, Old Testament wisdom literature, is a neglected resource in this respect. But the thing about wisdom literature is it's not, in that sense, specific to a particular time and place and culture. It's universal. So it's not going to be telling you, well, in the light of the transgender debate, in the light of, you know, the use of the internet, in the light of, it doesn't say that. What it says is there are wise ways of living, and they remain constant regardless of how society around us is morphing. And I think this is really helpful. So I think that wisdom teaching equips us to live in the world under the sun that God has created. And it teaches us how to approach the common issues of life. And this is why I say preaching that doesn't get to this point by way of application is a kind of asceticism, a kind of world-denying asceticism. Because it's really saying all that matters is that we get our lofty theology right. Not that there's anything wrong with lofty theology. But if we get that right, then we've got it cracked. And I think, no, we haven't. We're a long way off. Unless we can live as though that theology is real. And wisdom literature is something that teaches us how to do that. And by wisdom literature, I also include the Sermon on the Mount and the letter of James and all the insights into wisdom in the New Testament as well. Things like justice and injustice, integrity, family, reconciliation, forward planning. All these things are things which people out there are interested in. They're not interested in the lapsarian debate, or actually quite a lot of the things that we've been talking about very profitably in the last 2 days here. People out there think, but they are interested in these things, where the rubber hits the road for the man or woman living in a created world. And if Christians demonstrably have a way of negotiating their way through this created world that is demonstrably good, then I think people sit up and take notice. In the way that Potiphar thought, this Joseph is a good guy to have around. Now, it's interesting. It says that Potiphar recognized that the Lord was blessing Joseph. What does that mean? Does that mean that Potiphar did the theological arithmetic and, yes, it is the Lord that it... No, I don't think it means that at all. that is the reality. What Potiphar recognises that Joseph was being blessed somehow, blessing was attaching to him. I don't think Potiphar made the connection that it's Israel's God or anything like that. I think he just thought, he's a good guy to have around. The jailer, he's a good guy to have around. Pharaoh, he's a good guy to have around. Not because he's successful, because I think, you know, Christians are not called to be successful, but we are surely, of all people, the only ones equipped to live well in the world. Because we're the only ones who understand it by God's grace and through his revelation. Now, we would like to feel that wisdom is always rewarded, and it'd be so tempting to look at Joseph's story and see it in those ways, but actually, part of the Joseph story is that wisdom and righteousness can actually land you in jail. Nevertheless, Joseph carries on living in the same way, living in this wise way, regardless. And so living as Christians can either mean jail or high office or anything in between. And what we mustn't do is try to find strategies for how we live on, how we operate as churches in order to secure that outcome. Because it just won't work. The world will treat us arbitrarily. What we've got to do is keep doing the things that we know to be right. And I do believe firmly that people are looking for answers to questions that Christians can demonstrate. They have an answer that works in practice through the application of biblical wisdom. Now, having said that, Christian virtue will not necessarily be valued by society, but I think they should see something beneficial in the way that we live. And I think also we need humility. And I think this is something that particularly is necessary. I don't know, this is probably my third point here. I think sometimes Christians approach the world with a sort of entitlement mentality. That, well, because we've lived in a world, in a society where we've had Christian standards for so long, then we have the right to tell the world how to live, and we have the right to expect the laws of the land to reflect Christian values, and we can stamp our feet and get very hot under the collar if that doesn't seem to be the case. And I think we need to have a bit of humility here. This obviously reflects my ecclesiology and my non-belief in a state church and Christendom and all sorts of other things, which we won't get into. But I think we have no right to expect that society around us is going to live according to our standards. And I don't think we should throw up our hands in horror if it isn't doing that. I think there are times in the last 20 centuries when that has been the case, and there are times in the last 20 centuries when it has not been the case. And it may be that we're just in a phase where it's changing from one thing to another. So I think we need to exercise a certain amount of humility about what we reasonably can expect society to give us and what we feel perhaps we have to earn by the exercise of humility and wisdom. So I'm going to finish now. So when I stroll through the British Museum past the animal-headed deities, the cat mummies, the self-aggrandizing statues and the giant scarabs of ancient Egypt, should I regard these things as the products of a spiritually hostile, if not satanic, empire, unequivocally and implacably opposed to the living God? The answer in Genesis, no pun intended, is no. It's not that simple. And actually, in Genesis 12, you feel sorry for Pharaoh because he's been duped, and it's almost, you know, through no fault of his own that he's on the harsh end of God's curse. And Joseph has quite a good working relationship with Pharaoh. And the fact that Genesis 15 refuses to identify Egypt as that nation that will, in 400 years' time, oppress the Israelites, seems to be saying to me, it's not a simple black and white binary, the empire and Darth Vader kind of picture. Now, why does that matter? Well, when I walk out of the British Museum, this is the back entrance, in case you're wondering, what then how then do I view the society I live in? You see, I think our view of Egypt is conditioned by the first few chapters of Exodus. And that's not the only picture of Egypt. Now, even in Exodus, many of the Egyptians are favorably disposed towards the people of God. So, should I regard the society in which I live as the product of a spiritually hostile, if not satanic, empire, unequivocally and implacably opposed to the living God? No. For many Christians, our only meaningful interaction with society is evangelistic, and teaching on the Christian in society is concerned with the moral and ethical behaviour of the individual. The world is a dangerous place in which Christians can only experience contamination. Now, evangelistic activity and personal morality are laudable, but the narratives in Genesis are not teaching either, I suggest. But they do teach us some other things. We've got to have a nuanced view of society, not go into the world as Abraham did into Egypt and into Gerar, expecting the worst and acting out of fear of how people might treat him. Yes, we've got to have a clear understanding of where our allegiance lies, and also address our own propensity to see the unbelieving world as an alternative source of blessing. That is a serious issue. But we've got to recognise that we have a calling to be present, active and influential in the world. And that calling remains constant whether the world around us is positive or negative. We need to take much more seriously, I think, the call to live well in the created world. And as pastors, we need to spend more time teaching our people how to live a well-crafted life, which is what Proverbs and wisdom literature in general teaches us. This goes far beyond and in some ways contradicts the propagation of Christian culture. It goes beyond doing good deeds in order to gain evangelistic opportunities. To live well is the Christian's raison d'etre. That's why we're here. Trying to second-guess society's reaction and devising strategies to provoke the reaction we want are not within our remit. Any more than the Egyptians' treatment of Joseph was his responsibility. God may redeem Western society, or he may bring it to the ash heap. That's his prerogative. The church's calling remains the same either way. Thank you.